Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the entry of former Arkansas Governor and Baptist preacher Mike Huckabee into the 2016 Republican primary race, adding a combination of Christian fundamentalism and rural populism to the increasingly crowded field of presidential hopefuls. James Marone, a professor of political science and urban studies at Brown University and author of Hellfire Nation, The Politics of Sin in American History, joins us to discuss the extent to which the latest dead-on-arrival candidates are either running to revive their flagging careers in the media and lecture circuit, put their friends and families on the campaign payroll, audition for cabinet posts, or are running for vice president. Then, with a new study from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration warning the Earth has passed an unprecedented milestone with global levels of CO2 above 400 parts per million through all of March 2015, we will speak with Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel, who is a climate scientist who leads the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work. She joins us to discuss why, in spite of last year being the hottest in 135 years of record-keeping, that public opinion about the dangers of climate change lags behind the science. Then finally, as the various rebel groups close in on the embattled Assad regime, we will look into the portent of a second war in Syria after Assad falls between most of the opposition forces and the self-declared Islamic State. David Lesh, a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University and the author of Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, joins us to discuss the escalation of brutality and barbarity as the regime crumbles and the even greater bloodletting that will likely ensue. Joining us now is James Marone, who's a professor of political science and urban studies at Brown University, noted for his analysis of popular participation and morality in American politics and his work on health policies. He's the author of the award-winning book, The Democratic Wish, and his book, Hellfire Nation, The Politics of Sin in American History, received accolades from journals as diverse as Christianity Today and Playboy, and received a Pulitzer Prize nomination. His latest book is The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Marone.
I'm delighted to be here, Ian.
And this entry of Mike Huckabee, former governor of Arkansas and one-time Baptist preacher, into this crowded field of Republican hopefuls, obviously they're all going to be going after the evangelical vote, particularly in Iowa, and apparently the religious right is the largest voting bloc in the Republican Party. White evangelical Christians are about 40% of the Republican primary voters. So he did pretty well he won in 2008, but that was a different time and a different landscape. What do you think his chances are in 2016 or
early? His chances for being president are zero, very close to zero. His chances of winning Iowa are actually higher. Remember, he won in 2008, and in 2012, Rick Santorum, who was thought at the time to be a relatively marginal candidate, a candidate who had lost his bid to be reelected senator from Pennsylvania, and having lost the senatorial bid, thought, what the heck, let's raise the bar and go for president. He won the Iowa caucus because he managed to nose out people like Gingrich and Michelle Bachmann and Herman Cain for the Christian vote in Iowa in 2012. So you're absolutely right. It's a major vote. It has developed a reputation for choosing candidates who might be described as fringe from the perspective of the broader American electorate. The question you didn't ask is what counts as fringe these days? You look at the people who ran last time, and the fringe candidates all had a clear history in elective office. What's fascinating to me about the Republican field this time is really, and it's historic, for the first time, the Republicans have really begun to cut off their connection to elective office altogether. Last time, if you look at the results of Iowa, Santorum won, Romney, former governor, came in second, Paul, a congressman, from Texas came in third. Gingrich, former majority leader, came in fourth. Perry, a governor, came in fifth. So you have people all the way down the line, with one exception, and that was Herman Cain, who had a legacy of running for office and being elected officials. Now the list includes a surgeon with no elected office or political experience, whatever, Ben Carson, a former CEO who managed to run for a Senate seat in California once, Carly Fiorina, and never held political office at all. And in this field, Huckabee actually was governor once, and so he suddenly has more experience than significant members of the field, including the person who many think is the front runner to be the champion for the religious right, and that's Ted Cruz, who's managed 2 years in the Senate on the national stage before throwing his hat in the ring. So a party that has long been saying government is the source of the problem, not the potential solution, has developed to such a point where having government experience for the highest office in the land is no longer necessary to at least throw your hat in the ring.
And again, I'm speaking with James Marone, who's a professor of political science and urban studies at Brown University, noted for his analysis of popular participation and morality in American politics and his work on health policies. He's the author of the award-winning book, The Democratic Wish, and his book, Hellfire Nation, The Politics of Sin in American History, received accolades from journals as diverse as Christianity Today and Playboy. And
I love that you repeat that. That's one of my favorite things on my vita.
Well, it also got the Pulitzer Prize nomination. So in this Iowa caucus, if Santorum won last time and Huckabee the time before that, it sort of sounds like it may well be irrelevant. But at least Huckabee's going to have some more competition. You mentioned Cruz, Senator Cruz. His father is an evangelical and a Dominionist, the American Taliban, if you will. And then you've got Scott Walker. He's an evangelical Christian and also the son of a pastor. So maybe it won't be that easy for Huckabee this time.
It will not be at all easy for Huckabee. And if you're a Republican fuming at the mild tone of mockery that is just swamping the news waves when people like Donald Trump talk about being a serious candidate, it has to be said that the Republican field seems to include some very strong candidates, including candidates like Scott Walker and Ted Cruz, including candidates who appeal to the religious right, appeal to social and moral conservatives, but also are either, in Cruz's case, formidable debaters and formidable thinkers. Whatever you think of Cruz, he is a very shrewd man. And Scott Walker, who has the experience as governor of being a hard-charging conservative in a not very conservative state, and being, by most metrics, really very successful. So, and that's different. These are not all clown car candidates. They're really serious candidates. The Republican field this time is large, and it's going to be raucous. But it includes, in contrast, as you say, to last time, smart and serious candidates.
So we can pretty much discount the surgeon. I mean, he wouldn't be even a public figure, but for the fact that he's an African American. If he was a white conservative, he would be indistinguishable from millions of others. But
so along comes Ben Carson, who says that Obamacare is the second great sin after slavery, worse than anything since slavery. A kind of ludicrous statement to make. And the really interesting question is what if any is the effect of someone with out there, articulate, interesting, and full of hyperbole is way too weak a word. What's the word you'd coin for a statement like that one? The question is, what effect, if any, does that have on the race? Will he be president? No. Will he affect the debate that the Republicans have among themselves. That's the million-dollar question. If he develops a surge of enthusiasm, what does that do for the rest of the candidates? As you've pointed out, Ian, Huckabee, Cruz, Walker are going to be elbowing one another on the right for this vote. It'd be very helpful for someone like Walker to come out of Iowa first or near first, going into New Hampshire and South Carolina. Having someone articulating that strong a position, what does that do to the dynamic, particularly if in a debate or two before Iowa, that creates one of those little micro surges and a media and lots of media attention. You'll recall that last time Romney was injured because he found himself being outflanked on the immigration issue and had to make statements that later came back to haunt him in the general debate. And the question about Ben Carson is not will he be president, but how will he affect the conversation. The more articulate, the more excitement he generates, the more pressure he puts on the other candidates to say and do things they'll later regret. So that becomes the issue for the Scott Walkers. Can you retain your stretch to the middle and yet fend off the kind of excitement that a Ben Carson might develop? Now, he might also, the spotlight, the thing to remember every time someone announces is the spotlight is extraordinary. And you really don't know how someone will perform until they've been in it. The great story on that is the story of Sarah Palin. She emerged from nowhere and gave this quite extraordinary, really brilliant address to the Republican National Convention in 2008. And the Democratic campaign staff started to just panic. And Barack Obama famously shook his head and told them all to chill. And what he said again and again is no one walks onto the national stage and survives unscathed in the first couple of months of that scrutiny. He remembered for himself one of the coolest and most talented politicians in the last generation, maybe longer, and he was traumatized by that incredible spotlight. So in each of these candidates, the Carsons, the Fiorinas, the Cruzes, the Walkers, they've never had the spotlight, the incredible glare of a national campaign. People look very good when they first announce. Remember Rick Perry 4 years ago. They look very good, but that glare demolishes all but the most talented people. And for someone with no experience, it's really extraordinary. Last time, you'll remember that Herman Cain looked good for a while, but then as soon as the glare was on him, the stories of his private life absolutely demolished his reputation as well as his campaign. It just made a sort of pathetic sideshow out of him. And we can expect the same thing to happen to some of the people running this time as well.
Well, it does feel like a lot of them are running to revive their flagging careers, whether it's in the media or on speaking tours, or to audition for a cabinet position or the vice presidency. But one thing about slightly different about Mike Huckabee, who announced yesterday in Hope, Arkansas, the same town that Bill Clinton came from. He had Tony Orlando warming up the crowd, singing "Tie a Yellow Ribbon." But he did say that I will not be funded and fueled by billionaires, but by working people who will find out that a $15 or $25 a month contribution can take us from hope to higher ground. And then he went on to take a dig at Jeb Bush, saying, I don't come from a family dynasty, but a working family. I grew up blue collar, not blue blood. And he's not against eviscerating entitlements. So he's trying to sort of carve out a kind of Republican right-wing populism. Do you think he's got a snowball's chance? With all the billionaires and the Koch brothers, basically, and the Sheldon Adelsons. By the way, he wasn't invited to kiss Sheldon Adelson's ring, Huckabee.
Yes, well, you've given us a lot of things to chew over in just a second. But one thing about Huckabee, he was a barely known former governor of Arkansas last time he ran. No one thought he had the snowball's chance in hell. And after that run, he became a wealthy man, a popular commentator, a man who wrote a book on the campaign and did very well with that book, and now a household name. And he, if you invited him onto a college campus today, if you did before he ran last time, he wouldn't have drawn a dozen people, and today he'd pack the auditorium. So he's become a national celebrity by his run, and to some extent, the message goes out that if you succeed beyond all expectations and weather the spotlight, you can become wealthy and famous. And Fox News makes all kinds of things available to conservatives. So there's a different incentive besides being president. But you also commented on Huckabee's very interesting kind of his language and his platform, as you called it, right-wing populism. And exactly right. It is a mark to me of how the country and the conversation in this country has changed. Huckabee, if you close your eyes and occasionally let your mind wander, he certainly sounds like an old-fashioned New Deal populist, going after the wealthy, going after the people with the silver spoon, worrying about inequality, which he mentioned explicitly, mocking the wealthy. It was really quite an extraordinary performance, the kind of performance in the 60s that you'd expect from a dyed-in-the-wool lefty. And yet he's not a lefty. He's a very conservative Christian politician. It just suggests to me that there is something interesting going on in the conversation in the United States in 2015 that didn't exist in 2008, not the same way, that for all the conversation we've had about the Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street and all that talk about inequality has at least been a marker of something important that's in the air in the United States. And the Huckabee is finding an idea, a position out there on the right that I think is very interesting. We didn't really see last time, but it's anti-elitist, and not just anti-left elitist, anti-rich conservative a populist. And that's very interesting. And as I say, I think a great marker of where the United States is right now.
Well, just in closing, James Marone, I called a number of journalists in Arkansas who know Huckabee well, have covered him for years, and some of them were a little cynical, saying, well, you know, he's probably put all of his family on the payroll. I mean, it's possible to raise a lot of money and spend it, you know, and not necessarily, even if you don't have a snowball's chance in hell, you can ride the gravy train there for a while. It makes you very skeptical about the motives of a lot of these people running. But, you know, you mentioned earlier that he also thinks that Obamacare is the work of the devil. What are the chances of the Supreme Court striking it down? I'd covered it, those hearings when I was in Washington, and people are pretty nervous that it could go either way.
Yes.
If they do strike it down, it would organize the Democrats and give them an extraordinary platform to run on. And I suspect this very Republican partisan Supreme Court, for that very reason, may not want to do it because, you know, they'd be handing the Democrats a gift. What's your take on it just in the last couple of minutes?
Yes, it's extraordinary. The first thing to say is it's extraordinary how this issue has sustained itself among Republicans, that someone can say crazily that it's the worst thing since slavery when all the bad predictions that people would lose their health insurance in droves, that costs would go through the roof, that it would destroy the American medical system. None of that's come to pass. 15 million, roughly, people now have health care insurance that didn't used to have it. Not the answer to all the problems of American health care, but certainly no disaster in any obvious policy sense, and yet still fueling passion. I'm sure people are clicking off their radios all over Los Angeles just hearing me say that. The passion about this issue is extraordinary. So the Supreme Court, my prediction was that the Supreme Court had saved it once, it wouldn't save it again, and that the fault really lay not just with a Republican, slightly Republican-leaning Supreme Court that is 5-4, but in the Obamacare itself, that this is a law that is very hard to fathom, and that the Democrats, as they themselves say, never found a way to message it successfully. So what's at stake, most people don't even, still don't know, what's at stake in the Supreme Court decision is really quite simple. When you go onto the website and apply for health insurance, you are subsidized up to people making $80,000 a year. So if you don't qualify for Medicaid, below the poverty line, 138% of poverty, and you buy your insurance, the price you get figures out a subsidy from the federal government for people making up to $80,000 a year. It makes insurance affordable, all very nice. But most people have no clue that they're getting a subsidy. They just know they're required to buy health insurance, and this is what it costs. And oh, maybe if they look carefully, they see there's a subsidy. So what the Supreme Court is ruling is whether the subsidy that people don't even know they're getting goes away in 35 states. The reality we know, of course, is if it goes away, Obamacare collapses in all but the bluest states, which didn't really need Obamacare anyway, by and large. Slight overstatement, but not a very large one. So in the places where health insurance is hardest to get, you're essentially going to destroy Obamacare because the subsidies go away. The problem is that's very hard to explain. And the Obama administration has not in any way effectively explained what's at stake. Their naive belief was that the policy would be good enough, it would explain itself. And their opponents understood that nothing in politics explains itself. So the Supreme Court now, I've always thought, has a sort of free shot if they care to take it. Obamacare collapses, but no one really understands how. And so that if John Roberts this time wanted to say, no, the law is written in such a way that the subsidy goes away, no one would be quite sure what had just happened. And that, in turn, would give him a free shot and knock it down Obamacare. He couldn't have done it last time when the whole world was watching a very specific and easily explained Supreme Court decision. However, to knock it down, they have to be willing to create chaos in 35 states' insurance markets. And my reading, and you may have a different view having been there, but my reading of the colloquy on the Supreme Court was both Roberts and Kennedy was taking a deep breath and saying, good God, do we really want to create that kind of chaos for something that even conservatives I've talked to will smile when the cameras are off and say, yeah, we found a really nice little mistake in drafting this bill that we may be able to hang the bill on. But some of the people involved that I've talked to don't really believe that this was the intent of the authors. So the Yes. My guess is the Roberts Court will actually uphold it, just because the consequences for the states would be so wide and extraordinary. If they fail to uphold it, if they knock it down, it has to be said, Democrats can try and run on it, but they haven't set themselves up very well by explaining what's at stake. Usually when governments give people things, say Social Security or Medicare, the beneficiaries know exactly what they're getting and fight like mad. Obamacare has managed to do something really quite subtle, which is give people something that they don't know they're getting. That may have made it easier to pass,
right,
but it certainly makes it harder to defend. So my guess is if the Supreme Court knocks it down, Democrats will fume, but not having set up the debate clearly, they'll have a hard time holding the Supreme Court of the Republicans, but really making them pay a political cost for it.
Well, James Moroney, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was my pleasure. Always fun to talk to you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with James Marone, who's a professor of political science and urban studies at Brown University, noted for his analysis of popular participation and morality in American politics and his work on health policies. He's the author of the award-winning book, The Democratic Wish, and his book, Hellfire Nation, The Politics of Sin in America, in American History, received accolades from journals as diverse as Christianity Today and Playboy and received a Pulitzer Prize. His latest book is The Heart of Power, Health and Politics in the Oval Office. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back examining the latest study from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration about unprecedented levels of CO2.
When I don't care if it rains or freezes, long I got my plastic Jesus riding on the dashboard of my car. Through all trials and tribulations, and my travels through the nations, with my plastic Jesus I'll go far. Oh, plastic Jesus, plastic Jesus, riding on the dashboard of my car.
Now the deep water
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel, who's a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. She leads the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she has used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert Southwest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
And Brenda, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration have just come up with a new report saying that global carbon dioxide levels have gone above 400 parts per million throughout all of March of 2015, which is an unprecedented milestone. It's extraordinary to think how much the public opinion about how the real dangers of climate change lag behind the science at this point. It must make life for you rather frustrating.
Well, it's interesting because the atmosphere is quite nonpartisan. It just relentlessly is logging the effects of human-driven climate change. And this, as you said, Dr. Peter Tonz calls it a significant milestone. And I really didn't think I would see it this soon. An entire month average for the globe surpassing 400 parts per million.
And
it's
that,
really quite sobering.
And didn't the group that was set up, 360.org, Wasn't the idea of that 360.org was the limit, and now you're up to 400? I'm talking about the
Yes. The nonprofit group really trying to keep our target at least 50 per parts per million lower than we are at today.
Right.
And so that's really, really quite disturbing in that it means that we are seeing unprecedented levels of accelerated sea level rise. We're seeing punishing drought in the state of California. And really the snowpack has really taken a hit because we have all this heat-trapping gases trapping heat day in, day out, and preventing rain that falls in the mountains really falling in the form of snow. A lot of it is falling in the form of rain. And personally, it was quite sobering to see that the snowpack numbers as of April 1st, the water that is contained within the California snowpack are at the lowest levels ever recorded since they've been keeping records, which was the last time it was even low was not quite as low as 1976 and 1977.
So in terms of this lag between public opinion and the extent to which the public should be up in arms and demanding an end to releasing CO2 into the atmosphere, because we're already past the point where it's 350, you know, parts per million was the limit. We're at 400 now. For example, Representative Lamar Smith, a Republican of Texas, who is the chairman of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology, he just slashed funding for Earth science research in the NOAA budget and in the NASA budget, and then basically tried to say no. He's, you know, he's giving more money, but only to for space research as opposed to what's happening on this planet. So do you think he's getting away with it? I mean, I'm astounded. And it wasn't – how long ago was it? Back in January where the Senate voted 50 to 49 saying that climate change was not caused by humans. You know, we are the only advanced country in the world that's having this ridiculous debate. And it's bad enough that you got morons in the media saying this kind of stuff, but having them in charge of Senate and House committees, it's just mind-boggling, not to mention depressing.
It is surprising because those slashes, those proposed cuts to NASA and NOAA are critical not only for understanding what happens on, I would say, Earth is a planet in space that we do need to understand a lot about. It also is providing information from satellites that help save lives. I mean, when people are lost out along our coastal waters and you need the Coast Guard to try to have remote sensing information and understand the ocean currents and where people may be drifting and saving people's lives during extreme weather events. There's a whole bunch of series of tornadoes that are afflicting the country this evening in parts of Oklahoma and Kansas. We need those satellites giving us information that first responders can use to help save lives, and it all feeds into information about climate. Weather events add up to averages that lead to climate, and that all helps us understand a lot of aspects of the changing climate, which affects weather and other aspects. So to propose taking our eyes out of the sky and not maintaining some of these very important programs is really disturbing. But I would say that there is a sense of hope. I mean, I think because California, as you say, and Australia really is sophisticated in understanding this challenge, is also, as we point out, really has received benefits because, in essence, it's attracting $27 billion of venture capital flowing into the state for clean technology companies since 2006 because the state has passed policies that encourage renewable energy deployment and increased energy efficiency. And so, surprisingly, in 2015, California is really leading the states with 500,000 workers across 40,000 companies in 2015 working in this sector. So that gives me hope, even though we may see some disturbing signs perhaps on the national scene.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Brenda Eckwessel, who's a climate scientist from the Union of Concerned Scientists. She leads the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she's used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert southwest. So, Brenda, I noticed in the White House press dinner, the sort of comedy fest that they have where the president made fun of the press and vice versa, and he actually said some pretty funny things, and they were quite pointed, and he mentioned the senator from Oklahoma showing up in the Senate with a snowball, the climate denier. And he really did eviscerate this guy. And you wish that, you know, that he would take the gloves off on a full-time basis as opposed to in a jocular way. Given how strident some of these climate deniers are, do you think that the people who support the science and the 97% of all scientists support the science, are they just being too polite?
I think some of it really is important to perhaps use in a comedy setting to call attention to some of these tactics that are quite unforgivable given the level of knowledge. And as you said, over 97% of the scientists understand what's happening and are conveying the facts that are on the ground. And yet there have been efforts to try to show some of this deliberate misrepresentation of the facts by some select group of individuals, and that's featured in a movie that's been going around this springtime called Merchants of Doubt, and it's something that you can watch and see the behind-the-scenes story for what's been happening with why some people might be showing up in the Senate and throwing snowballs, which was, of course, a humorous event, but it's really not a very funny thing because people are dealing with a massive drought in California. There are natural cycles that lead to droughts in California. However, there's strong evidence that climate change is making this more severe.
So, but why is it, for example, that Germany, that has so little sunlight compared to California, have managed to switch to solar and wind? At one point, half of the grid in Germany was being fed by solar and wind.
There were massive incentives that Germany, and if many people may remember, a lot of people were looking forward to international agreements on asking nations to really do massive cuts to their emissions of heat-trapping gases to the atmosphere. And Germany and the UK really leading the way on creating policies to reduce emissions in their countries. And people are looking forward to the Paris international negotiations coming in late November, early December of this year. And some massive changes are likely to be renewed since, I'd say, the time when the Kyoto Protocol was first drafted. That agreement is far too weak to deal with the challenges that we are facing.
So when the co-founder of 350.org, Jamie Henn, says that these benchmarks that were just released by this NOAA study of all throughout the whole month of March of 2015, the global atmosphere contained more than 400 parts per million of CO2. And their group, of course, is called 350.org. So we've passed that benchmark. He's saying it's an urgent signal that we need to leave fossil fuels in the ground. This may not be our climate Rubicon, but we're certainly standing on the shores of disaster. What's your sense of that? Is that seems like a fairly cogent and prescient warning.
It's very important. 400 parts per million in the atmosphere of carbon dioxide is something that will last for decades, and some part of it, about 20% of it, is going to be trapping heat day in, day out for 800 years or longer. So we've really locked in some climate change that is sobering for sea level rise, because some of the ice sheets may take a while to melt and shrink, and some of it may be faster than we expect. So we have to think about ways of reducing emissions really rapidly to avoid some of the worst consequences. And some people are looking at ways to capture carbon dioxide and sort of sequester it by growing more trees, by making sure that our forests in the United States don't succumb to wildfire and release all that carbon that may be stored for, in some cases, can survive and last for 800 years in some of the desert regions of the Southwest. And if that goes up in flames, that means that 800 years of carbon sequestration has just been released to the atmosphere. And so people are looking at land use changes in the United States that can offset our emissions to try to give us a leg up as we try to get a better handle on how to reduce the core cause of climate change, which is burning oil, coal, gas, and unfortunately tropical deforestation and wildfires.
Well, Dr. Brenda Ekwesel, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Brenda Ekwesel, who's a climate scientist with the Union of Concerned Scientists. She leads the Union of Concerned Scientists climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she has used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert Southwest. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into a second war in Syria after Assad falls.
There's been a crash on the levee and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. It's gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Oh, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. Gonna have to find yourself. He will.
Man has invented his doom. First step was touching the moon. There's a woman on my block, and she sits there in a cold chill. She says, who's gonna take away his license to kill?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He has written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, A History, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, and Modern Syria, and his latest, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. David Lesh.
Pleasure to be here again, Ian.
And you're just back from Turkey, and it's pretty clear that your book title, the last book, The Fall of the House of Assad, seems to be actually, you know, it's obviously been predicted before on a number of occasions that he was about to go under, but it looks like he is beginning to go under. Is that your read on what's happening?
Yeah, I think it could be the beginning of the end. Certainly, I think the narrative has changed, where the Syrian regime has, over the last 6 months to about a year, has been saying it is the only one that could win and the only entity that could reunite Syria. And the recent losses, significant losses on the battlefield, I think has punctured severe holes into that narrative. However, I think it remains to be seen whether this is a game changer in the near term or the long term, because as you said, the regime's funeral has been predicted on several occasions, and it comes back. And usually it comes back because, after various opposition victories, infighting occurs amongst the opposition groups that carried out these victories. So it remains to be seen whether the more coordination and cooperation and unity among some of the opposition groups in Syria, particularly in the north, if that holds, and if it holds in the long term. And I think, the key is that they had some victories. And so as long as they have some of these victories and it shows that coordination and unity works, I think they'll stay together longer. But, if the key will be if the regime turns some things around, and they will to a certain degree, I think, if they go on the offensive and the opposition, it experiences some losses, will, they break apart as they have in the past. So, the story is not over. But I think that, when this thing ends, this could very well be the point where we look back and say that, things have turned around.
Well, I suspect, though, that what we'll see, and we're starting to see it now, is more and more of hideous human rights abuses and desperate military action in the use of chlorine gas bombs, which apparently the Assad regime is using chlorine gas now, and they just blew up the hospital in Aleppo with barrel bombs, and it's been abandoned by Médecins Sans Frontières. They've just basically said that the whole hospital's a write-off. So are we going to head into a real chapter of, I mean, this has been a disgustingly bloody and brutal war so far, but are they really going to take the gloves off on both sides?
I think so, unfortunately, particularly, not that the regime can get much worse than what they have done, but desperate times require desperate measures from their perspective. And I think one of the things that they've been, unfortunately, successful in doing is carrying out these barrel bomb attacks, which tend to alienate the civilian population to the various opposition groups that are supposed to protect them. And so with the recent gains, particularly in the city of Idlib, in the north of the country, one has to wonder whether or not the regime will start hitting that much more severely than they have. And will that sort of action produce some of the cracks in the opposition that has occurred in the past? So it is unfortunate, but I think the situation in terms of human rights violations and civilian casualties will get worse.
But that's a very bizarre and kind of callous calculus, isn't it? The idea that you use unconventional weapons like chlorine gas and barrel bombs on civilian populations in order to turn them against the rebels who quote have liberated them. You'd think that logically all it would do would make the people hate the Assads even more. So is there any evidence that kind of psychology is working?
Well, I think it initially produces a great deal of anger, but after a certain amount of, it's now, of course, we're into the fifth year of this conflict, after a certain amount of time and death and destruction wrought all over the place that has occurred in Syria, people start to get very weary and look for any sort of stability, even if it comes from the regime which has caused much of this death and destruction. And this is what has been happening with these so-called reconciliation agreements, particularly in the significant city of Homs in recent times, with people just basically exhausted and doing a deal with the devil, so to speak, just to get on with their lives and escape this sort of thing. And so that has been the Machiavellian strategy of the regime, and it has worked on occasion. And I fear that they're going to continue that type of strategy.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He's written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, A History, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, and Modern Syria, and his latest, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. So I think it's pretty clear, and I've talked to a number of analysts who've said that Assad would have already gone under were it not for Iran's resolute support, particularly using Hezbollah to bolster the ranks of the Alawites. That clearly Assads are running out of cannon fodder. I mean, the young Alawites apparently are slipping out of the country if they can. So he's got a real problem, but how is this going to affect Israel? My understanding, the Israelis were very happy with Assad. As terrible as he was, he brought stability, and he was somebody that could sort of follow the rules and wouldn't do anything rash. But if he's more and more in control of the – if the Iranians are more and more in control of this guy and he depends more and more on them, well, are they going to end up having more influence in that part of the world? And that's not going to make the Israelis very happy.
No, not at all. And I think that was behind their – of course, they didn't claim responsibility for it, but most believe that it was an Israeli attack on the Golan Heights, which at the time killed some Iranian Revolutionary Guard soldiers as well as some Hezbollah operatives. And I think it was a message that the Israelis were sending that, Iran is not, going to be on our back porch. And I think that's very much how they see it now, where, for the first certainly 2 or 3 years of the conflict, they were kind of split over whether or not to stay out of it. You know, do we want someone like Assad who, even though, you know, is against us, you know, as you said, is predictable, or, you know, do we help overthrow Assad and therefore maybe a radical Islamist government or power or just chaos, you know, on the border? And I think now they've veered toward anything but Iran being on their back porch, especially with the U.S.-Iranian rapprochement agreement that may come in a couple of months, which may or may not secure an Iranian position in Syria. But certainly, as you said, the Syrian government has more and more relied on Iran and Hezbollah. And does this mean that the debt that Assad, should he survive, or should any sort of supporters of Assad survive, you know, is that a debt that will be repaid for quite some time, that they cannot get out of the embrace that they've exhibited toward Iran? And I think that scares Israel quite a bit. And so, I think there are some in Israel, maybe more than some, that would rather just see chaos, because they can deal with that, even if there are some radical al-Qaeda-like groups or ISIS or something like that in various parts of Syria. They can deal with that rather than having a more secure Iranian presence and influence with the regime that with which they had great disagreements to begin with.
So, David Lesh, clearly the both sides are incredibly brutal, and I'm not sure what the U.S. is getting for its $500 million training up the Free Syrian Army. Far as I can tell, they barely exist. They're supposed to be working with the Islamic State and al-Nusra in the suburbs of Damascus in the Palestinian camp there. And Assad's apparently got a pro-Palestinian group fighting against them. But the prospect, and this is what the glue that Assad's used to hold his coalition of Alawites and Christians and secular people together, is that you know, these religious fanatics are going to kill you. And frankly, is that what's going to happen if Assad falls? Is there going to be just a bloodbath?
That's the big question. You know, my sense is that to some extent it's inevitable. Should, you know, the center and you know, just collapse, and you may have a situation such as that which existed in Iraq. Of course, we had 150,000 troops exhibiting some stability for some time, preventing all-out chaos and civil war, but eventually that even broke down in Iraq. I think it probably will be even worse in Syria. There are some interesting, you know, developments. The Jabhat al-Nusra group, which is the al-Qaeda-aligned group, there are reports that, and they're the ones that played an instrumental role along with some other Islamist groups and some non-Islamist groups in the capture of Idlib and in some other areas in northern Syria and some victories that they had in the southern front along the Jordanian border. But there's some reports that there are elements of Jabhat al-Nusra who want to formally break away from al-Qaeda and make it more of a, you know, a Syrian Islamist group that will have more appeal to the populace. And there was one particular military commander in this new Jaish al-Fatah, Army of Conquest group that carried out the conquest of Idlib, who said, well, of course Syria is going to be Islamist, or it's going to be Muslim, but not too Islamist. You know, they don't want to scare off the more secular elements of the country, whether they be Sunni, Alawite, Christian, or something else. But you're going to have a hard time convincing them of that based on all of the bloodshed and the recriminations and the propaganda from both sides that have made the narrative much more sectarian than perhaps it really is on the ground.
But if it were, now that the I think it's the Islamic State largely is poised right at the heartland of the Alawite heartland, not far from Latakia, which is the mm-hmm. ground zero of the Assads and the Alawites, what happens if they can move those few kilometers and take over, and then there'd be this wholesale panic, people would be trying to get out? There's no referee in this, is there? There's no. Nobody wants to get into this mess. So if the bloodletting starts, there'll be nobody to stop it, right?
Yeah, and you know, this is the decision that this new, you know, army of conquest that, again, made up of a number of different groups, has to make right now. You know, do they move toward the coast into the Alawite strongholds, or do they move further south toward Hama or toward Damascus, try to help out the southern front military opposition? And, you know, I think, you know, strategy has played an important role in some of the gains they've made. I think they've made a strategically smart move and finally bypassing Aleppo and trying to hit areas where the government is more vulnerable and overextended. But what's interesting is, you know, in talking to pro-government people as well as opposition leaders, you know, over the last 6 months or so, both of them, both sides, they talk of the next war. And, you know, that is the next war that will be fought after this one is settled in one direction or another or through a political settlement. And that next war is against ISIS. You know, the opposition speaks of this, including even some Jabhat al-Nusra elements, as well as government and pro-government elements. So this is unfortunately probably the way it will go unless ISIS crumbles and implodes like some predict it will. But there'll still be elements of it controlling some parts of Syria. So this is a long way from being done.
Well, there is this strategy called the flypaper strategy, where you get all the crazy jihadists in one spot and then you kill them. This has often been expressed, but the U.S. doesn't have the means to do that. No Christian army can go in there, assuming that they're already aware of the second war, the victors, the Syrian elements of the opposition, as opposed to these sort of outside parasites have come in with the Islamic State. If they turn on the Islamic State, who's going to help them?
Well, I think in that case, and this is one of the reasons why some elements of Jabhat al-Nusra are interested in breaking away formally from any association with al-Qaeda, is that they'll make them more acceptable to the regional players, such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey, and even international players, such as the United States, even though, you know, they espouse an ideology that may not particularly align with the United States. I think the big red line is that has prevented the U.S. from really supporting some of these groups is the fear that our intelligence or our weapons will end up in the hands of al-Qaeda groups. So and it's these victories recently and this new dynamics in the battlefield which has started this discussion. So it'll be really interesting to see if they do indeed move in that direction, and if so, will the international community insert itself more vigorously?
Well, David Lesh, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He's written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The Arab-Israeli Conflict, A History, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, and Modern Syria, and his latest, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.